Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your host for the show. This morning, we'll hear from two local speakers about people who are often dismissed from full participation in society, immigrants and the mentally ill. Clatsop County District Attorney Josh Marquis is an advocate for the mentally ill. He says what we consider to be normal can be measured on a sliding scale. We'll also hear from Greg Delgado, an organizer for CAUSA, Oregon's immigrant rights organization. Both appeared in Astoria during the Stand Up Stories event in March. Their speeches coming up just after NPR News headlines next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Josh Marquis has served as the district attorney for Clatsop County since 1994. As a litigator, Marquis is no stranger to public speaking. He was recently a participant in the Stand Up Stories event in Astoria last month. The event featured local speakers on a variety of topics. We'll hear from two of them this morning. First, Josh Marquis on access to mental health services in our area.
My name is Josh Marquis. I am the district attorney of this county. I want to start off by admitting that there is no such thing as normal. Each of us can be placed on a broad spectrum that ranges in psychological terms from being so well-adjusted you are like the Dalai Lama, which I think is what we all aspire to, all the way to people whose brains give what we call command hallucinations, which tell them to do violent and often scary things to themselves and other people, or severe autism, other things along the scale of what we call mental illness. Now, the vast majority of us fall somewhere along that continuum. And before we label people as mentally ill, we need to understand that we all have our quirks, many of which are described in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual 4R, revised, which is the cookbook used by psychiatrists, psychologists, and therapists to diagnose everything from eating disorders to depression to antisocial personality and the more common early onset adult schizophrenia. At the risk of branding myself crazy, a fairly meaningless term, which has no real significance in either the medical or legal communities, I want to tell you a little story about when I started in the field I'm in the early 1970s. I worked in the DA's office in Eugene, and they thought it would be a good idea to start testing cops for their psychological well-being, to make sure that you just didn't get the high school bullies as cops, which in some communities was a problem. So they gave a test called the MMPI. Some of you may be familiar with it. It means Minnesota Multiphase Personality Inventory. It's about 500-600 true-false questions. And it asks their validity scales to see if the person is malingering, and it tests things like paranoia, psychopathic personality, depression, hypomania. So after the score of the test, the shrink looks at me and kind of arches his eyebrows and says, well, you're pretty high on the hypomania scale, and you do have a few aspects of OCD, but don't worry, you're not mentally ill. My point is that for many of us, the very things that give us drive, passion, or creativity may also be viewed in a cold clinical light as a deviation from normality. One of the problems with the MMPI is it's often given to people in jails. And the classic questions that usually trigger paranoia are things like, I smell strange smells. People are looking at me all the time. People are listening to me. Well, guess what? When you're in jail, you do smell strange smells. People are looking at you. We are after you. So they're really not paranoid. So it's very important to note that the psychiatric profession clearly distinguishes from two radically different kinds of mental illnesses. Thought disorders, which are generally treatable, and personality disorders, which are generally not. And those are the people, I'm not going to talk that much about them. Those are antisocial, narcissistic. Generally, you ask a psychiatrist, what's the treatment for that? The answer is none. But there are treatments for thought disorders. Now, we live in a remarkably free society in Oregon where there's an appropriately very high standard for the involuntary commitment of people. And usually what happens is family members come, they are at the end of their rope, and they say, we need help. In Oregon, in order for someone to be mentally committed, they must, one, be chronically mentally ill, and have one of the three following characteristics: be an imminent danger to themselves, an imminent danger to others, or unable to care for their basic needs. Now, this doesn't mean bad eating habits like the ones Cindy thinks I have, which are probably in the long term not good for my basic needs. And it doesn't mean that at some point, maybe 2-3 weeks ago, the person, it means right now. So if that doesn't happen, the judge is not going to be able to commit that person. And yet, I watch with small degree of sadness as I watch the sheriff's office chain people up just like you would somebody accused of murder and take them from Astoria to the nearest psychiatric bed, which is often in Ontario, Oregon. So they're going to drive 7 hours chained up from here to there and then back. I can't believe that's good for anybody. Now, the mere fact that someone's clothing, hygiene, even behavior is unusual or really bothers people is not and should not be the basis for commitment. And we all, some of the greatest artists in the world, were awed to the point of sometimes, you know, actually being self-destructive. Nobody wants to see anybody commit suicide, although it is often very difficult to intervene in the slower methods of self-destruction, such as the growing curse of heroin addiction in both Clatsop County and Oregon. But the mere fact that someone's an addict is not a basis for committing them. So what can we do? What should we do for people whose mental orders place them at risk? Now that we've established that we all fall somewhere in that continuum, I prosecute hundreds of criminals every year. A good 75% of them suffer from severe substance abuse disorders. Some of them are what are called dual diagnosis. They have an underlying mental disease of some degree or another compounded by a substance abuse. I don't think, however, that the mentally ill commit crimes at any greater proportion than the so-called general population. So the mere fact that somebody is bipolar does not mean that they're predisposed to commit crimes. A woman, however, is standing naked in driving rain out here on Marine in the middle of and swinging at cars at night. The police are going to have to take that person into custody. And where are they going to take them? There's only one place to take them in here in this county, to jail, which is not a good place for anybody. The officers generally record all of their encounters now with these little lapel cameras, so we know exactly what happened. And I have to say, I am really moved by the compassion that I've seen a lot of these officers show for people who are, frankly, floridly psychotic. But jail is a poor substitute for other facilities, virtually none of which exist in our community. Despite people like, and I'm looking right at her, Juanita Pryster, she's right there, her thing's back there, the indefatigable head of the National Alliance for Mentally Ill here in Clatsop County. And the professionals at the ER and the people at Clatsop Behavioral Health. So how do we balance the civil rights of all citizens, even those with profound disorders, with the idea that we want to protect people from and not allow them to literally die on our streets? Well, one of the advantages to living in a smaller community is there aren't 6 degrees of separation, more like 2. And what I mean by that is somebody will come up to me in the post office and start telling me this heartbreaking story about how they've tried everything and they've called all these people and all they get is voicemail. They find the services are lacking. They're concerned their father, their son, their niece, their daughter, their loved one, their partner is going to die without intervention. They're convinced of that. And I have to be honest with them and tell them, look, the best possible legal scenario is an involuntary commitment to the Oregon Health Authority. And what does that mean? That means that they will hold you up to 6 months and they will pump you full of antipsychotic drugs, which have some really nasty long-term side effects. And as far as I can tell, I will read the psychiatric records, and they'll say milieu therapy, which as best I can tell means they stick them in a room with a bunch of other profoundly mentally ill people and a television set and some board games, and they milieu around together, literally. Dr. Sharon Mirnan, who is a ER doctor in Portland, wrote a really interesting op-ed that you can still get online in last Sunday's Oregonian, decrying the practice of boarding psychiatric patients in ERs. Now, and her point was it's cruel, there's nobody looking after them, they're not getting treatment. She's right, of course. The difference is in Clatsop County, we don't even get to put them in an emergency room because we have no safe rooms, none. 2 hospitals, 0 safe rooms. Now, I'll be blunt, the reason is the hospitals don't want them. Emergency room doctors want to treat people, triage them, and frankly, a crazy, violent, dangerous person flailing around is going to disrupt that. So they just say, look, we want them somewhere else. Now, the historical basis for this miserable commentary is American social engineering. There were snake pits. Anybody who ever saw Frederick Wiseman's wonderful thing called Titicut Follies, which was an amazing documentary about a Massachusetts mental hospital, or saw the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, actually filmed at the old Oregon State Hospital, and the doctor that interviews Jack Nicholson was Dr. Dean Brooks, who was the actual head, just died a few weeks ago. Nice man. The result, though, that was the horror at all this is, well, let's deinstitutionalize. And this meant everybody, and frankly, this is Republicans and Democrats both. Reagan started this when he was governor of California, but Democrats, frankly, adopted it on a different level, saying, we'll have community supervision. We'll shut down these snake pits. We'll put them out in the community where there'll be halfway houses. Well, guess what happened? We just dumped them out in the street. We have people, again, command hallucinations of things would order you to do something. Now, some might argue that the freedom to live under a bridge is a lifestyle choice. And I suppose that is, but many are prisoners of their own illness, unable to get any access to medication or therapy. And I frankly get pretty pissed when I see in Portland where they seem to sort of celebrate homelessness with the fact that most of those people, or many of them, are children, drug addicted, living in enormously deplorable conditions where they're going to be sexually exploited and injured. And I suppose everyone has a right to live under a bridge, but most of us are probably not going to choose that if we have a chance. I'm often cross-examining experts because I can't afford them, so I have to cross-examine them. And I'm told I'm an overly concrete thinker, which is not meant as a compliment, by the way. It's actually a claim that I'm slightly, you know, mentally ill. But I'm concrete in the sense I want to know, what do we do here in Clatsop County? You know, what can we do? We have one psychiatrist, MD, who's part-time. The county has for many years outsourced its mental health program to a Portland-based outfit called Clatsop Behavioral Health. I work with many of their workers. They're underpaid. They're overworked. A couple years ago, we had dedicated housing in Uniontown. That's been closed down. We have Open Door. The theory is people can come in, get their medications maintained. That's now operated on a peer-to-peer basis. That's just not good enough. So think globally, act locally. Here's what we need to do, and soon. We need one or two safe rooms in this county. Two, we need housing for people who are mentally ill, who can live independently with some assistance. But the big one is that the county needs to put some skin in the game, by which I mean money. Virtually all the money we spend is pass-through money. It's federal money and state money, many of which has come from the good Senator Johnson and our Ways and Means Committee. But guess what? If you look at the county budget, not one dime is our money, Clatsop County money. I'm sure the county manager will not be happy to hear that, and he'll probably say to me, well, where do you want the money to come from? I have no idea. I'm not the county manager. But we, the county, its citizens, need to prioritize our response to this crisis. Frankly, we need to spend a few a few hundred thousand dollars of our county money, not just grant dollars, to hire locally based mental health professionals who I'm convinced live here. I've met some of them, both at the MSW level, maybe higher. This won't be cheap. I'm talking about people who live here, who know the community, who know the difference when I say, oh, they're living in Taylorville versus they're living in Gearhart. Most of you immediately know what I'm talking about. But if you don't live here and you don't, that's not going to mean anything. This won't be cheap, no more so than the justice system, which never can be or should be a revenue center. We don't make money off of helping people get better or holding people accountable. And if we do, there's something seriously wrong with the problem. So we are currently, and this is not as upbeat as some of the other speakers, but we're failing people in this community. We're failing their families, and therefore we're failing our community. So things need to change. In early May, the County Budget Committee meets, attend, speak, advocate. It's often been said a society is measured by the way it treats its most vulnerable and most concerned citizens. I feel that way about animals. It's a completely different issue, but I think our hearts all go out in the same way. And I am part of that system, so I feel a sense of personal failure as well. Every time I do one of these hearings, and we succeed in committing somebody, and I'm not sure we're really doing that much good for them. So this is wrong. We need to start turning it around. So my first suggestion is that you show up and convince our county commissioners that it's time, as I say, to put some skin in the game. Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Still ahead, Stand Up Stories continues with the immigrant experience in Astoria from Greg Delgado, who experienced an aha moment while working in a restaurant in Bend.
I've been in this restaurant for about 3 years, and this young man walks up in the kitchen, and he just got out of culinary school, and he says, if I ever open a kitchen, I'm going to hire all Mexicans because I can pay them less and they work harder.
Immigration as a global and local issue just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region today. Patchy morning fog, then partly sunny this morning, mostly sunny later on. Highs today 55 to 60 with north winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. Then tonight partly cloudy, overnight lows in the low 40s. Greg Delgado is an organizer for CAUSA, Oregon's statewide Latino immigrant rights organization. It's the largest Latino civil and human rights organization in the Pacific Northwest, working for Latino immigrants and their families on issues such as affordable and accessible education, housing, and health care. Delgado participated in the recent Stand Up Stories event. Here's his take on the immigrant experience in Oregon.
My name is Greg Delgado. I'm with CAUSA, Oregon. First, I'm going to start a little bit with my story, and then I'm going to give a local story, and then we'll move from there. But I'm from Southern Arizona myself. The issue, I'm going to speak on immigration and the driver card and our Latino communities here in Oregon. We're one of the fastest growing communities in the state, so I'm very proud to say that we're going to be everywhere, and we're moving forward. Originally, I'm from Southern Arizona, where the border issue and the immigration issue was on a daily, where you heard the stories of the people, the death in the border, where you see the people crossing on a daily basis. Even before that, my grandfather and was from, we were all from the Southern Arizona region, Latino, Native American. Very proud to be Yaqui, Apache, and Latino at the same time, and American as well. So, and I remember the stories from my grandfather telling us when we walked, when he would walk through the desert from Nogales to Tucson barefoot because he didn't want to dirty his shoes to go to the dance. I remember the stories from how they used to carry trade across those borders. Nowadays, it's not the same. That border has changed. It is a military-industrial complex with a big, huge fence and helicopters, and you have it all there. So it's a whole different story now than it was back in the day of my grandfather. So, but the reason I'm bringing that up is because one of this story that happened to me in Bend was I was working in a kitchen in Bend, and this is kind of an aha moment for myself. There was a group of people on the line in the kitchen. I was cooking there, and I'd been in this restaurant for about 3 years. And this young man walks up in the kitchen, and he just got out of culinary school, and he says, if I ever open a kitchen, I'm going to hire all Mexicans because I can pay them less and they work harder. And everybody thought that was cool. And they was like, yeah, you know, it was very fine. And I had that moment. It's like, really? I've been here 3 years, and this is what I'm going to hear. And yes, I was making less. I was actually cleaning toilets and mopping floors to earn extra income because I wasn't getting paid enough there. And then I thought, this is not an immigration issue. This is not a Mexican issue. This is how we as a community and as a society treat each other and how we look at each other. You know, I'm a third, fourth generation American here, and I'm very proud to say that. And so that made me realize we have to make some kind of change. That was my last kitchen job, just to let you know. That's when I became an activist. So, and then after this, thank you. So after that, the other story is a young family, the Tapia family. Liliana Ramos has three children. She was undocumented. Her three children are born in the U.S. Now, these three children were in Bend in high school and junior high. And one day, she was a supervisor at a local hotel there. The immigration office came, and they actually went with three Suburbans to her work and picked her up and took her. And nobody knew what happened to her. Her kids called me crying, concerned, couldn't find their mother. We later found out that the mother had been deported. She was in a deportation process. She was a single mother. And in the past, her husband and her had separated, but he had started an asylum process, so they gave her a temporary social. Well, she just did what she could to survive and to raise her family until that one day they came and abducted her. That's exactly what they did. Nobody knew what happened to this poor woman. The three children were left there. So at that moment, this family's life has changed also. These three U.S.-born children, when she said, my children are U.S.-born, what do I do with my children? The Border Patrol, the ICE customs people said, take them with you. So this is our U.S. government telling them, take U.S. children from this country and take them away from here. So it was a very scary moment for them. Now, at that moment, all these kids' lives have changed. Her life has changed. Obviously, she's deported. She's in Tijuana now, living by herself over there. And oddly enough, something amazing has happened. She, out of her misery, has created a support group and also a shelter for women facing the same issue. It turned out that in Tijuana, I went to go visit her over there. There are hundreds and hundreds of women facing the same issue. They're deported and their children on this side. And many are being adopted out because after 60 days, it's a child abandonment issue. So there's a lot of this. So to help herself, she's helping other people over there. But the other issue is her three children in the United States now. One of them just graduated high school, who almost did not graduate high school because she was so depressed and so angry. She struggled through high school. But we got her counseling, and we were there for her as a community. We worked together to help her, support her through that. Her son, the eldest, he just turned 21. We're looking to get her to try to get a deport, get her back through him as an adult now. But the fact is, both of their lives have changed. No more dreams of college. No more dreams of a childhood. It's all gone. They are now struggling just to get their mother, support the mother in Mexico. She has a job, but they have to support her because of the income that she has over there, barely enough to subside on. So they're struggling now. Their lives have changed completely. And the reason I bring the two stories up is because the thing we have in common, we are all Americans. We are all Americans, but these stories have so many different sides to them, and it changes lives everywhere. So the point of the stories is we have to learn to respect one another, regardless of our citizenship. I think we have to work together more as a community. The Ramos family was a big story on how the community came out and supported them. We did fundraisers to help get the attorney's fees, and they actually were able to get her to stay to get her process delayed a while so she can get her affairs in order. But this brought a community together to understand, and a faith-based community and a whole community say, this isn't about immigration. This isn't about papers. This is how we treat each other. This is how we look at each other. Immigration, the Latino issue is one, but there's so many aspects to immigration right now. It's a global issue, and we have immigration from all over the world. And how are we going to look at that in the future? We did in the past with NAFTA. That created a lot of this issue. And now we're coming across with the Pacific Free Trade Agreement, another one. What is that going to look like? Is that going to create millions, 20 more million? Or are they, like they said, on steroids of more immigration to our country? Well, how do we address that? And how do we look at each other, one another, as neighbors? And how do we build communities? How do we work together as a community to envision the community we want to live in? So we got to work together to find those kinds of solutions. And it starts one community at a time. And we've been working really hard to do a lot around that in our community of Central Oregon. But I think Oregon is a great breeding ground for that kind of reality. People here, they learn to love and respect one another and how to build a strong community. And then we got to put that forward and bring that message to the nation as a whole. And one of the other things I wanted to mention today also is about Oregon driver card, which falls into this too. 80,000 people in Oregon lost a driver card to the signature. They tied it to the Social Security card. It was a driving issue. It's a public safety issue, and they tied it to a social. So now 80,000 people that were driving, taking their kids to school, going to work, are now without a driver card because they don't have a path to citizenship. We make this path to citizenship impossible. We don't give them a driver card, and we just leave them in our communities. This process is antiquated, and it's backwards, and we need to find changes for that. But there are some amazing things that happened. CAUSA and many other coalition of organizations worked together for 3 years to fight for the driver card. We last year in May, our governor signed it on the steps of the Capitol into law with a bipartisan support to pass this law. Now, unfortunately, right after that, the next day, there was a petition signed, sent in, and we went to a referendum. So just to let you know, the money for that referendum came from out of state. It came from somebody working on one of the opposition parties funded the referendum, and it's going to go to vote in November. But this is a public safety issue. It's not just about a Latino issue, and it's about a neighborhood issue. We as communities have to learn how to work together and how to come up with a solution that respects all of us and our communities, because I'm looking at communities like Bend and Hermiston in Ontario that are 30 and 40% Latino these days. We have a lot of Latinos in our communities. We're growing. We're building communities. We're starting businesses, building families. And so how do we make that all work together? And it's not about, can we just take one person out of that community that has no papers? Because we're mixed status, okay? And that's not just the undocumented people. We have over 200,000 in our state alone. But that doesn't include children and U.S.-born citizens also that are Latinos. So we have a lot of culture in our communities. We need to learn how to embrace that instead of push it away or look at it in that fear thing that people look at through, that lens. I think we just have to kind of have the conversations and learn how to work together to find solutions. And that's pretty much what I wanted to say today. Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the home page. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's N-E-W-S, then the numeral 1, at kmun.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane saying thank you for listening today. Listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.